'Tis with very much pleasure now then that I ask Brother Simon Griffiths to come forward and speak to us upon the kingdom and the land.
First of all, a crumb of comfort to those who are bleary-eyed and still half asleep. We shan't be going at anything like the pace that we went last night. We shall, as the psalmist often says, pause and consider. Would you turn with me, please, to Genesis and chapter 12? Our subject, as Brother John has already said, is the kingdom and the land. And we need to be careful as to just what land it is that we are talking about, who it's been promised to, and why it's so important. And we make no apology to going back to basics, Genesis chapter 12, and in particular, well, we look at the first three verses. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. So immediately that Abraham is given an instruction, he is to be shown a land. And then in verse 2 he is promised that he will be a great nation and all blessings will be in him. So immediately, as soon as we come to the promises, the land is in the forefront. And we soon find out the land being spoken of, on into verse 7. We find by then that Abraham has come into Sychem or Shechem, and the Canaanite was then in the land in verse 6. And verse 7, the Lord appeared unto Abram and said, unto thy seed will I give this land, the land that was at that time inhabited by the Canaanite. And in chapter 13 and verse 15, again we see the land. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. So it was all the land which could be seen from that particular point, and it was promised to Abraham and his seed forever. Now just one more reference in Genesis, and it's chapter 15 and verse 18. Genesis chapter 15 and verse 18, in the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land. Now here is the land. From the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. So those then are the borders of the land. We have the river of Egypt, which is the Nile, across to the Euphrates, and all this land in between is the land promised to Abram. And some have in the past suggested that the river of Egypt is not the river Nile. To do so we have to tinker with the words that are there, because the word is river, and it's the Hebrew Nahar. And if it was to be the Wadi al-Arish, it would be the word Nahal, a Wadi. But it isn't. It's the same word as the river Euphrates, a great river, and so it is the river Nile. And so that is the area promised to Abraham. Now he was told, and the children of Israel were told time and again, 20 times to be precise, that it would be a land flowing with milk and honey. And there's one special occasion, it's Ezekiel and chapter 20, where that description has an addition made to it. It's nearly always described simply as a land flowing with milk and honey. But in Ezekiel and chapter 20 and verse 15, we find there these words. Yet also I lifted up my hand unto them in the wilderness, that I would not bring them into the land which I had given them, flowing with milk and honey, which is the glory of all lands. It is the glory of all lands. Now at the time that the children of Israel went in to the land which was then known as Canaan, it was indeed a glorious place. Remember, the spies went out and they brought that huge bunch of grapes to show how fruitful it was, and they declared how fruitful a land it was. But it is described here as being also the glory of all lands, from which on the surface we may seem to say that it is the best part of the earth's surface, and so indeed we believe that it will be. But the word glory means prominent, conspicuous, and beautiful. Now the third one, the beautiful, gives us the idea that it will be the best part of the earth. But in this word, we also have a clue as to what is to happen to the land of Israel, which we're going to have a look at in a moment. Because it's not only beautiful, remember, but it is prominent and conspicuous. And the Hebrew language being what it is, this really is a marvellous expression. It is the glory of all lands. Because this word glory comes from a root, a Hebrew root meaning to array an army against. And in the context in which we're talking, that's remarkably significant. Remember how last night we described that all nations would be gathered together to Jerusalem. All of the armies of the lands gathered together. And yet it is also the glory of all lands. And we find the word used in Isaiah 29. We'll just have a look at Isaiah 29 just to show how this same word describes an army. Isaiah 29 and verse 7. And again, the context is remarkable because Isaiah 29 deals with, as you see in verse 1, woe unto Ariel, Ariel the city where David dwelt. Well, we don't need to guess where that was. We're told later on, that in the chapter, that it is Jerusalem. And we suggest that it's particularly significant because the other time that we come across Ariel in Scripture is in Ezekiel chapter 43 and describes the altar in the temple which is to be erected at Jerusalem. It has a name. It is called the Lion of God, the Ariel. We shan't look at that in any detail, but it links into, therefore, it links this chapter with the erection of Ezekiel's temple. And in that context, and we come to verse 7, the multitudes of all the nation that fight against Ariel, even all that fight against her and her munition that distress her, shall be as a dream of the night vision. All of the anguish, all of the fighting, and of the armies and the distress and the conquering nations in the land will have gone. And the glory of the kingdom of God will begin to be established. And that is the same word that is used. The army brought against Jerusalem, against Ariel. And so that land flowing with milk and honey is the object of all nations. They go towards it. They want it for themselves. But it is not to be. As a dream in the night it will be. And so we want to go back now to the reading which we read together, which is Zechariah and chapter 14. Because in Zechariah and chapter 14 we get some detail as to what is to happen in the land of Israel at the time of the return of Christ. Remember, we have already seen from Ezekiel and chapter 20 that the land is described with that word glory as being conspicuous. Well, if we go to Zechariah and chapter 14, just picking up in verse 2, which we read together last night, I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. There is no doubt, as we saw last night, this is the battle of Armageddon. And it is at this point that the nation of Israel will, for all practical purposes, be defeated by the invading armies. And we saw from Habakkuk last night that it is Christ and the saints who will save the nation of Israel from that time of distress. Now we're going to see exactly the same thing from Zechariah. Because, verse 3, then shall the Lord go forth and fight those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. Now when he fought in the day of battle, of course, it's a reference back to the time when the nation of Israel had their enemies round about them. And the nation of Israel fought their enemies and they won. It's described here as the Lord going forth. It is Yahweh himself in control of world events, fighting for his people, making sure that this time they will be victorious once and for all. And he does so in particular through, as we said last night, the returned Lord Jesus Christ and the immortal saints. And it is they, verse 4, who will stand on the Mount of Olives. His feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west, and there shall be a very great valley, and half the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south. Let's just stop and think what we're being told in that verse. We think that we know about earthquakes. From time to time, there are indeed what we consider to be severe earthquakes, where the surface of the earth trembles. It doesn't move very far, it just shakes. And it may be sufficient to bring to the ground entire cities. Remember, there was an earthquake in Mexico. And the actual centre of the earthquake was out in the sea, wasn't it, if I remember rightly? But it destroyed a good deal of a city in that country. And thousands were made homeless. And all that happened was, the earth just shook a bit. Didn't move anywhere. It just trembled a little bit. And it caused vast amounts of destruction in that particular part of the earth. And we consider that to be a disaster. Well, indeed it was. Let's just look again at verse 4 and pick up what's happening. Christ and the saints are on the Mount of Olives by Jerusalem. And it doesn't just tremble a bit. The Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof. It splits right down the middle. And the east, the midst thereof, toward the east and toward the west, and there shall be a very great valley. So this mountain, the Mount of Olives, is to split in two. The earth has seen nothing like it since Noah's flood. The earth is to split. And remember that the Jordan Valley is the northern extremity of the Great African Rift Valley. If you cast your minds back to your geography in the school days, that valley, that Rift Valley, which goes right the way down through the eastern side of Africa. A great fault in the surface of the earth, and it is that fault that is going to move. And we shall see, provide a way for rivers, but we shall come on and see that in a moment. And so a great valley is to be made. Now remember that it is at this time that Christ and the saints are to save the nation of Israel. So then Israel will be covered with an invading army. And it is this earthquake that plays an important part in the defeat of that army. Just as an example, keep a finger in Zechariah. Just as an example, come back to 1 Samuel and chapter 14. And see what happens just when the earth shakes a little bit. The 1 Samuel chapter 14. Now the context of this chapter is that Jonathan and his armour bearer have gone to fight the Philistines. They haven't taken an army with them. From human point of view, they've gone on their own. But remember, of course, Jonathan is a faithful man. So Jonathan and his armour bearer go, and they go towards the garrison of the Philistines. And In verse 15 we read, 1 Samuel 14, there was a trembling in the host. Now, it's not the host of Israel because they hadn't got the army with them. So it's the Philistine host, the Philistine army. They are trembling in the field. And among all the people and the garrison and the spoilers, they trembled. And the earth quaked. So it was a very great trembling. So here a faithful man, Jonathan, goes to take the enemy of the Philistines only with his armor bearer, but there is an earthquake and the people are frightened. They tremble. And verse 16, the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah and Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away. Now note this, they went on beating down one another. So all Jonathan had to do was stand and watch while the Philistines fought amongst themselves. Why? Because of an earthquake. But look a little more closely, if you have a margin, at the end of verse 15, so it was a very great trembling. The margin has a trembling of God. And to be more precise, it is a trembling of the Elohim. It is the angels working the purpose of God, supporting that faithful man, Jonathan. And they caused the earth to tremble a little bit. And the army of the Philistines fought itself. Now put that in the context of what we read in Zechariah. It's not just a trembling, it's a whole-scale movement of the surface of the earth, such as not been seen, as we said, since the days of Noah. That army, those armies which are upon the nation of Israel, will be terrified out of their wits because of what is happening to them. There will be destruction upon every side. All the buildings will come down. The earth will move, and we shall see in a moment there is even more movement. But it will be a terrifying experience for those that are there. And that is part of the way in which the invading armies will be defeated. And remember what we said in when we saw how Egypt was to be smitten. We saw last night how they fought one another. It's exactly the same thing, fighting amongst themselves, because they are so terrified as to what is going on, they have lost all consciousness as to who they're fighting. And so because there is this great destruction which is taking place, one of the first things which has got to happen is that the land of Israel will have to be cleaned up. And bear in mind that we read elsewhere, we shan't turn to it, that a third of the nation of Israel will be destroyed. There's something in the order of 4 million Jews in the land of Israel, a third of whom are going to die. So well over 1 million people are going to die, just of the nation of Israel. It will be a terrifying time. But the land will be cleansed. So let's have a look at Ezekiel 39. I said we're going to go back to Zechariah, we will do, after we've looked at Ezekiel and chapter 39. Ezekiel 39, verse 1, therefore, thou son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, thus saith the Lord of God, behold, I am against thee, O Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. So here is the army of the king of the north. It is the Russian army. Remember, he has many other nations with him. And they are brought upon the mountains of Israel, verse 2. But verse 4, thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel, thou and all thy bands and the people that is with thee. I will give thee unto the ravenous birds of every sort, and the beasts of the field to be devoured. And thou shalt fall upon the open field. So destruction coming upon them. And so verse 7, I will make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel. I will not let them pollute my holy name any more, and the heathen shall know that I am the Lord, the Holy One in Israel. and see what happens. Verse 9. They that dwell in the cities of Israel shall go forth and set on fire and burn the weapons, both the shields and the bucklers and the bows and the arrows and the hand staves and the spears, and they shall burn them with fire 7 years. And so they shall burn the weapons. Verse 10. And verse 11. It shall come to pass in that day I will give unto Gog a place there of graves in Israel, in the valley of the passengers. The passengers means the people who pass through. And shall stop the noses of the passengers. It will be most unpleasant. And there they shall bury Gog and all his multitude. And 7 months, verse 12, shall the house of Israel be burying them, that they may cleanse the land. And that is the point. There is all this destruction, but the land is to be cleansed. And all the people of the land shall bury them. And it shall be unto them a renown in the day that I shall be glorified. And so at the end of verse 14, those that remain upon the face of the earth to cleanse it at the end of 7 months, shall they search. So that they'll search the land to see if there's anything they've missed, and it will be cleansed. And so, the land then restored to a glory. And so in those circumstances, the temple and the land will begin to be reorganised and the temple will be built. But still, let's go back to Zechariah now, still we haven't described the preparation for the site of the temple. The temple which we can't actually refer to because that's Brother Keith's subject, and so we must try and keep off that. But we must prepare the ground. Now we've said that the Mount of Olives is to split and that it will be a tremendous earthquake such as has not been seen. But there's more to this if we go into verse 10. All the land shall be turned as a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. Let's just define where we are first of all. Geba is some 6 miles to the north of Jerusalem, and Rimmon is 30 or so miles to the southwest. So we're talking about quite an area, which is described here with its northern and southern parts, some 36 maybe more miles apart. So it's quite a sizable area. So what's going to happen to this land? We're told quite clearly, it shall be lifted up. Remember we said in Ezekiel, it will be conspicuous because it is being lifted up. Now the word turned in verse 10, according to the concordance, is to surround or to border. To surround or border. Now of course, if the land is being lifted up, it will be surrounded or bordered by part of a valley. It may be an escarpment. In other words, the rest of the land will be flat, but this area which we have described will be raised up, and then the temple again will be raised up on Mount Zion itself. So we see in the land a wholesale change, and the land, the centre of the land, raised considerably from the way it is now. Now there is a brother who has made a diagram of this. It's in Brother Benson's book, The Stormy Wind Fulfilling His Word, if you want to look it out. But the diagram at the top shows a cross section to the land of Israel as it is now. And the low point there is the Dead Sea, which as you can see at the moment is about 800 metres below sea level. That's about half a mile from the sea level of the Mediterranean to the bottom of the Dead Sea. Now you see how the brother there has shown it changed. Let's move it up a bit. In the times of which we speak, how the land, you see what was the Dead Sea is described as the Living Sea, and he's showing that diagram that it is above the level of the Sea of the Mediterranean. Now it doesn't actually tell us that in as many words in Zechariah, but we shall see in a moment how he comes to that conclusion. So, a large change. Now, just think of that. When we said that part of the land would be raised, we're suggesting that that portion of the earth's surface is going to move something like half a mile straight up. So that is the scale of the sort of thing that we're talking about in Zechariah chapter 14. It's a vast movement, a whole section of the surface of the earth, such as we have not seen the like. Well, now we would have a close look now at verse 8 of our chapter. Because it says in verse 8 of Zechariah 14, "It shall be in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea, and half of them toward the hinder sea. In summer and in winter shall it be." And the same brother has prepared a diagram which shows the sea, which was the Dead Sea, towards the bottom there. And remember that we have just read that there are rivers going from Jerusalem, in verse 8, going out towards the sea. So the rivers are going to go from Jerusalem and towards the sea. And they will go north toward that sea, and east and south into this sea here, and perhaps even on down through the wilderness. And so that is why that land has got to move so far, because this has obviously got to be higher than the Mediterranean Sea. And since it's already half a mile below the Mediterranean Sea, it's reasonably obvious it's got to move at least that far. So those waters then going from Zion, from Jerusalem. And whenever we come across verses, I say whenever, that's an exaggeration, often when we come across verses which describe the kingdom, once you start looking for it, you'll be surprised how often we come across a reference to the waters. And just look again in verse 8, because it says, "It shall be in that day," this is not ordinary water, "living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, and it shall be summer, and in winter shall it be." So these are described as living waters. Now let's have a look at Ezekiel in chapter 47. Now Ezekiel, the latter chapters of Ezekiel, describe in great detail the temple which is to be erected on this site, remember, which has been raised up and specially prepared for it. It's turned as a plane, so the top of it is to be level. Now in chapter 47 of Ezekiel, verse 1, "Afterward he brought me again unto the door of the house," that is, the temple which he has described in some detail, "and behold, waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward." So these waters literally come from within the temple, and they come out from the temple under the threshold of the house. And verse 2, "Then brought me out of the way of the gate northward, and he led me about the way of the gate of the utter gate, by the way that looketh toward the east, and behold, there ran waters on the right side." So, on the north side and the south side, there are waters coming out of this temple on either side. And we're given a very graphic description of the way these waters gradually get deeper and deeper. Verse 3, "And when the man that had the line in his hand went forth eastward," so he's at the western end, "he measured 1,000 cubits, and he brought me through the waters, and the waters were to the ankles." And so Ezekiel has gone, and he has come, for example, from this end. He's come 1,000 cubits or so, so he's around here somewhere, and the waters he describes as being ankle deep. But then he moves on, verse 4. He measured 1,000, another 1,000 cubits, and he brought me through the waters, and the waters were to the knees. So he's come along a little further now, along here, and he's discovered that the water's a bit deeper. He's now got up to his knees. And so another 1,000, still in verse 4, and he brought me through, and the waters were up to the loins. So Ezekiel, in his vision, has had to go through this water. He's found ankle deep and knee deep, and now he's up to his loins at the end of verse 5. And so verse 5, afterward he measured 1,000, he's now gone beyond the end of the temple. If you add up your thousands, he's now over here somewhere, right at the very eastern end. And where were we? Verse 5, and it was a river that I could not pass over, for the waters were risen, waters to swim in, the water that could not be passed over. Now, of course, the reason that the waters are getting deeper and deeper is because there are waters coming out from each of the thresholds, each of the gates along here. So the water comes, we shall see later on how the water comes from underneath the altar. And this is a depiction of the water coming down what is Mount Zion, upon the top of the elevated part, remember, right at the very top. And it comes down out throughout the gates, and it comes out this way toward the east, and so gets deeper and deeper as the various tributaries gather the one to the other. And so this is where the water comes from. And so verse 6, he said unto me, Son of man, hast thou seen this? Then he caused me to return to the brink of the river. Now when I had returned, behold, at the bank of the river were very many trees on the one side and the other. And we shall come back to the trees in a moment. But notice verse 8. Then said he unto me, These waters issue toward the east country, and go down into the desert, and go into the sea, which being brought forth into the sea, the waters shall be healed. Which is why in the previous diagram we have the Dead Sea became the Living Sea, because the waters are healed. So the water goes out from Jerusalem down into what was the Dead Sea, but is now the Living Sea. In verse 9, it shall come to pass that everything which liveth, which moveth, whithersoever the rivers, notice in the margin, if you have one, it is the two rivers, so there's one going out toward the north, as we said, one going out south and to east. The rivers shall come, and there shall be a very great multitude of fish, because the waters come hither. So the abundance of fish is because of these waters, which we saw previously, are living waters. For they shall be healed, and everything shall live whither the river cometh. And remember, it is going through the desert. Now a good deal of the land which was promised to Abraham, left to itself in the present circumstances, is desert. All the land to the east of the River Jordan is largely desert. Sinai is desert. It needs to change. We may say that a good deal of the land of Israel, as occupied by the Jews, has been turned into a very fruitful land, and so it has. But it has been, they have done it through irrigation schemes, all of which will fall into disrepair because of the earthquake. And so it is these waters that are going to really make the land of Israel a land flowing with milk and honey, because of these waters which bring life wherever they go, not only into the Dead Sea, but into the desert. It will become a very fruitful land. And so, verse 12, And by the river upon the bank thereof, on this side and on that side, shall grow trees for meat, whose leaf shall not fade, neither shall the fruit thereof be consumed. It shall bring forth new fruit according to his months. Look at the reason again. because the waters, they issued out of the sanctuary. So we're told quite clearly where the waters come from. It is the sanctuary, as we see it on the diagram. But just notice those trees. The trees on this side and that side shall grow trees for meat, for food. So these aren't just ornamental trees, they are trees for food. And it may be that circumstances will revert to the way they were in the time of Eden. Remember, Adam had his food from the trees. And I would suggest that the circumstances described in the early chapters of Genesis are the circumstances which will pertain at the time of the kingdom. In other words, there will be four rivers altogether, and it will be very good. It will bring forth fruit abundantly. And remember, when we see the surface of the earth, and some of it appears to be very fruitful, but it's still cursed. But the rivers will bring life. And so it will be very, very fruitful. We shall see just how fruitful in a few moments. And so the waters come from the sanctuary, still in verse 12. The fruit thereof for meat, and the leaf thereof for medicine. And so there won't be hospitals full of people who need all manner of drugs which man can make. The leaves thereof of these trees for medicine. It's not just in the land of Israel. These rivers water all the deserts round about. And I believe they will go for many, many miles. And so the area of land associated with these rivers will be nothing like the sort of thing that we see today. A very fruitful land. Trees that we've never seen anything the like. Bringing forth new fruit, not annually, not according to its years, but according to its months. So it's a monthly cycle of bringing forth fruit, not an annual one. And as we have seen, the leaf thereof for medicine. And so the waters then coming out from under the from the temple and bringing abundance and life wherever they go. The whole land being transformed. And we shall see now just to the extent to which they are transformed. Let's have a look at Psalm 72. Psalm 72, and I just want to pick up one verse. Remember, Psalm 72 describes how it will be in the time of the kingdom. Just one verse, verse 16. There shall be an handful of corn in the earth upon the top of the mountains, and the fruit thereof shall shake like Lebanon, and they of the city shall flourish like grass on the earth. So the tops of the mountains won't be barren, rocky, inhospitable places. There will be fruit upon them, and there will be corn upon them. So the surface of the earth is to change. Amos in chapter 9. Just note the description here, just how fruitful the land will become. Amos and chapter 9. Amos in chapter 9 and just verses 13 and 14. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that the ploughman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of him, the treader of grapes, him that soweth seed, and the mountain shall drop sweet wine. So there are to be vineyards on the mountains, and all the hills shall melt. Then I will bring again the captivity of my people, and they shall build up the waste cities and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and drink the wine thereof. And they shall make gardens and eat the fruit thereof. And I will plant them in their land. They will no more be plucked up out of the land. So the restoration of the land, closely associated with the restoration of the people. But just notice the terms of verse 13. The ploughman shall overtake the reaper. Now of course if that literally happens, the harvest is destroyed. What is being described here is that the harvest takes so long to gather in because the land is so fruitful that the ploughman wants to get on and get on with his job. But the harvest is so great, so fruitful has the land become. So a great change to take place. At your leisure, have a look at Isaiah chapter 25. Isaiah chapter 35, where the waters again are mentioned, where the desert shall blossom as the rose. Totally different place for the people of Israel to live in. And just in the last couple of moments, we want to have a look now at the way the land will be organised. Because you remember when the people of Israel inhabited the land, they were given certain parts that they could dwell in, and it was Moses and Joshua who said that they could have certain sections of the land to dwell in. They were all around one another and a bit here and a bit there. And what we want to emphasise is that the nation of Israel is to be restored to its land. And turn to Ezekiel in chapter 48. And whilst you turn to Ezekiel 48, you find there described that which is shown on the diagram. And Ezekiel and chapter 48 is very, very clear. Ezekiel chapter 48, it gives a northern border in verse 1, which is up by Damascus and the coast of Hamath. And at the end of verse 2, for these are his sides, east and west, a portion for Dan. And verse 2, by the border of Dan, from the east side unto the west side, a border for Asher. And so the chapter goes through and shows, as you see, Dan, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Ephraim, Reuben, Judah, and then a portion in the middle called the Holy Oblation. And then southern tribes down below. Notice going right the way across to the River Nile in the west. But there is a section described as the Holy Oblation. Now we're not going to spend time looking at the verses because our time is rapidly disappearing, but I just want to pick up, you see, this section here, the Holy Oblation, because there is a very special portion of the land. And it's something that we want to mention so that we can pick it up this evening, just so that we can see where that portion of it, of the land, is in relation to the other tribes and in relation in particular to the temple. It may not be too clear on this diagram, but that small mark there represents the temple. It's in a little more detail on there. The Holy Oblation, and it's still not too big because of the scale of it. The temple is right in the middle there. And this is a section of the land which will be given to three separate parts. The northern part to the sons of Zadok, which we shall mention this evening. The middle portion for the restored tribe of Levi. And the second part, the possession of the city. Again, we shan't try and attempt to explain those just now. We'll leave that for later on. But suffice it to say for now, there is this very special section of the land of Israel, the very centre of which is the temple. That's a common mistake, it's not absolutely true. The very centre, of course, would be somewhere here. But the temple is a little to the north of centre, just on the border between those two sections there. And so the temple is to be built on that site, specially prepared, in a land which is so different to the way it is now. A fruitful land. A land which the people will want to inherit. A land that people will want to go and see. Because it is the very centre of the kingdom of God. And God willing, after coffee, Brother Keith is going to describe to us from Isaiah chapter 2 the wonders and the glories of that land and of that temple.